Welcome to Under the Fig Tree podcast with hosts Reverend Dr. Ben Haupt and Reverend Micah Glenn. In today's episode, Ben and Micah sit down with a special guest as they meditate under the fig tree.
What's up, what's up, what's up, and welcome back to another episode of Under the Fig Tree. I'm your host, Reverend Micah Glenn, the Director of Recruitment here at Concordia Seminary, and I'm joined by my highly esteemed co-host, Reverend Dr. Benjamin Haupt. How are you, bro?
Good, good. It's Monday here, and so just coming off of a weekend and enjoyed some family time. Our listeners know that we're big into Legos and comic books, so I got to read some comic books this weekend. We went to a Lego convention.
Nice.
I geeked out, and so I feel refreshed, and I'm really excited to be back for another episode.
I think we've probably talked about this. So Dorothy comes from a big Lego family, but I don't. I had friends who had Legos, but I had Ninja Turtles and G.I. Joes anyway.
Yeah.
But my especially one brother-in-law buys Lego everything for each one of my kids. But like, what are they into? And we tell him, thinking he's going to get a gift geared towards that. And he does. And it's a Lego version, which is fine. You know, I try not to throw the pieces away when I find them, if I can recognize them. But nonetheless, because, you know, the special ones, the last one was Raya the Last Dragon for Talitha's birthday.
Yeah.
And there are pieces that just don't look like Lego pieces.
Right. Right.
Well, anyway.
Yeah, that's the new version of Lego with all the themed sets. But yeah, we've banished them to a specific place in the house because I was tired of stepping on Legos.
And see, we've tried, but my kids aren't quite at the age of responsibility yet where they stay where they're meant to stay. Yeah. Well, you know, football is officially back.
Oh, yeah.
Listeners know I'm a big Dallas Cowboys fan. Now, they lost by 2 points on Thursday, but to the reigning Super Bowl champions, Tampa Bay Buccaneers, led by Tom Brady. And before the game, not to be like one of those downer fans, but just based upon our starting quarterback got hurt last year, hadn't played in almost a year, I assumed they'd get blown out. And it took a last-second field goal by Tampa Bay to win the game. And our kicker, who had off-season back surgery, missed the extra point and a field goal he should have made. So that game was very winnable by the Cowboys. And if they're going to play like that all season, guys, I'll be very – I might be unbearable as a co-host. See, last year when the Cowboys were trash, you guys just listened to me bemoan the fact that they weren't very good. But if they're good this year, just be ready. That's all I'm going to say. But we are joined by a special guest, as you heard in the introduction. Today we are joined by Dr. Rick Mars. I was going to call you Richard, but everybody calls you Rick.
Yep, okay. That's what I put on the cover.
bang, bang, there we go. So Dr. Mars is a professor of practical theology. Ben, you're the one who usually introduces your fellow faculty members.
Yeah, absolutely. So Dr. Mars has been a professor both here at Concordia Seminary as well as at some other institutions of Lutheran higher education. His primary emphasis or his specialty is pastoral care and counseling, and he has a new book out, fairly newish, but really a neat thing because it's published by Westbow, is that
Westbow,
right?
Yep. Zondervan, yeah.
Zondervan, yeah. The thing that's really exciting about it is Dr. Mars has an audience and has a voice to the wider Christian world, but brings all of the Lutheran goods to the party. So really, really is one of these people that is bringing the gifts of LCMS Lutheranism and our theology to the entire world. And so the book is Making Christian Counseling More Christ-Centered. And I know, Dr. Mars, that there's a story about you talking with somebody, a Christian counselor who wasn't Lutheran, and you had an exchange with that person about law and gospel. And does that matter in Christian counseling? So tell us a little bit about that and a little bit about the book.
Yeah. Actually, multiple conversations like that with multiple friends throughout the, it's like year 38 or 39 that I've been in the Christian counseling realm before. I was a Christian counselor before I became a pastor, because I didn't become a pastor until age 42. And yeah, various conversations, one particular Baptist friend who we were talking about this, and I handed him a copy of that C.F.W. Walther, God's Yes and God's No, the short version of Law and Gospel that CPH published years ago. He read that in like 2 or 3 days and came back and shook it in my face and said, "You're right. You Lutherans take an extreme position on grace." And just going, "Yes,
yes, we do. Thank you very much."
Yeah, yeah. So he and I actually co-authored an article with a similar name 20 years ago before the book. So,
And so the idea of so Christian counseling has always been scripture centered, right? Lots of scripture in it. But what's unique about your approach in this book?
Actually, the field kind of has two divisions. There's a biblical counseling field that is very scripturally oriented, and then a Christian counseling field that the biblical counselors tend not to use psychology as a foundation. Mm. They want to just use the Bible. Scripture is sufficient is kind of what the biblical counselors tend to say, although, again, they vary some too. And then Christian counselors tend to use modern psychology, but then bring theology into that to what they call integrate theology with psychology. I'm not completely comfortable with either one of those, but I do respect both of those sides. I've tried to write something that I think speaks to both of those groups, because it is very scripturally based, but it is bringing Luther's soul care theology. That's the phrase I've been using over and over again. A lot of people think that Luther started the Reformation because he wanted to have debates with, you know, Roman Catholics or whatever, and that's not what was going on. He was concerned about the souls that he was caring for in Wittenberg, and there were people that were coming and trying to harm those souls by having them pay money for a piece of paper that would somehow bring them forgiveness and get them out of purgatory, and he knew how wrong that was, so he put up 95 theses to start a debate. But it was a debate about the care of souls. Mm. And he was a very talented soul caregiver himself. We have 2,600 letters that he wrote to various people over those decades that he was a leader in the church. And he was a very gifted soul caregiver. And now then, well, the Christian counseling field and the biblical counseling field is actually very large in the United States. There are 50,000 members of one group, AACC, American Association of Christian Counseling. I'm getting ready to go to Florida on Thursday, actually, to present at that conference. Hmm. 7,000 people will be at that conference.
Wow.
So I don't get to talk to all 7,000, but 75 have signed up to hear Luther's soul care theology.
Cool.
And I specifically didn't use the title of the book this time. I specifically, Luther's Soul Care Theology for the 21st Century is how I entitled it. So I get to speak to 75 evangelicals that are interested in Luther's soul care theology in some way. There will be a few Lutherans there, but I always estimate that it's like 1% Lutheran that goes to this conference. So I like having the ability to share this. And, again, I first made a presentation like this about 10 years ago, 11, 12 years ago. Not very many people get to present at this conference because it's, again, overwhelmingly evangelical, and the evangelical leaders kind of control, but they've invited me in 4 or 5 times now to speak, and I'm very pleased to be able to do that. So
that's really exciting. It's neat as a faculty member to see my colleagues have these national and even international reputations, and as they're writing, as they're speaking, as they're teaching, that their voice really does go out to all parts of the world. And in that way, I think that's part of what Luther was trying to do in the Reformation, right? He wasn't trying to create a little sect or a little just a little group of Lutherans where we would just kind of go off and be on our own. He was trying to reform all of Christianity, mm-hmm. right? And so, and a huge part of that was his care for souls. That came out really clearly for me when I saw that Luther movie in like 2003, 2004 that Thrivent helped to put out. It was really well done to show kind of Luther behind the scenes and how much he cared for these individual people.
Mm-hmm. The scene from that movie that always stands out to me is when he's burying the young man who commits suicide in the church cemetery, as opposed to cast off by himself, and is preaching to the people about what the young man is going through and what led to him committing suicide as he's burying him. It's such an important thing.
Yeah. Which is what, I have a chapter in the book about Luther's soul care abilities himself. He's the first person in history that we know of who was compassionate towards people with psychoses, with schizophrenia, what we would now call schizophrenia, another side of psychotic. He was the first person to say, we should be compassionate to those people. Wow. All the historical evidence we have is that medical doctors and pastors and priests were making fun of those people prior to Luther. He was the first one, well, since Augustine, to start to be compassionate towards people who had died by suicide, to their families and so forth. And so not just the first pastor, but the first person to do some of those things, and motivated by the gospel.
Wow. Well, tell us a little bit about your path. You mentioned that you're a little bit later to life becoming a pastor. So give us a little bit of your life story and how God worked through all those circumstances to bring you to become a pastor, because our listeners are right in those places where they're doing maybe a whole variety of different things. Some of our students come straight through the system through college, but a lot of them don't. And so you were a second career pastor. Tell us a little bit about that path.
Yeah, mine's an interesting sort of meandering. I was pre-seminary. I was probably 16 or 17 years old in high school. I started seriously contemplating pastoral ministry, and then I went to St. John's College in Winfield, a Lutheran college that's now closed. Winfield, Kansas, and I was pre-sem at that two-year college, and I was taking both Old Testament classes and psychology classes from our esteemed colleague Tim Seleska's father, John Seleska, who taught at St. John's before he went to our sister seminary in Fort Wayne. And John's now sainted, but he was just a tremendous mentor and influence on my life during the 2 years that I had him for a professor. But I always say to people, he got me conflicted, because he got me interested in psychology, which I had no idea what that was when I was 18 years old. But I became interested in the field, so I decided to major in it when I went to Concordia River Forest, Chicago, for my second 2 years of college. And then as I was graduating from college, should I go to seminary? Should I go get graduate school in psychology? I'm not sure yet. So I'll just be the department manager in charge of fertilizer at a grain elevator back in Kansas. So I grew up, perfect vocation. Yes. I grew up on a farm, so working for the local grain elevator was not a big stretch. And I did that for about 9 months. And another pastor had challenged me and said, you don't know enough about theology to become a Christian counselor. You should go to the seminary and at least get an MA at the seminary before going on to grad work. And so I had a break. There wasn't much to do with the grain elevator in the spring. So I went to the boss and said, could I go and take a leave of absence for 3 weeks and 3 months? And he said, sure. I don't have to pay you for 3 months and you're just sitting around. I'd be happy to do that. But come back this summer, because the summer is really busy. So I came and took 10 weeks of classes, one of which I teach now, pastoral counseling, at least the derivative of that. And Martin Henschke was just a very wonderful professor who took us through some of the current readings of biblical counseling and Christian counseling and Lutheran ways of thinking about those things back in 1981, and helped me to realize, this proper distinction of law and gospel is incredibly important. But then I didn't come back for that fall for the MA there. I went to grad school at University of Kansas. I then was asked to be an admissions counselor at St. John's College in Winfield, which then led to me being asked to be a young instructor and counselor there for the last 3 years that it was open. And then when it closed, I was asked to go and teach at Concordia Chicago. And so I taught there while working on a PhD. In counseling psychology at Loyola, went there for 12 years. And then at age 39, 40, I looked at my dear wife and said, honey, would you stay married to me if I left academia? I was being a successful professor at Concordia Chicago. I was associate professor. I was about to be promoted to full professor. And I looked at her and said, honey, I think I should be a parish pastor. And she said she would stay married to me. And so we carted up the kids. You know, we had kids at ages 9 and 5 right then. We went and lived out in the woods and had a great time for 2 years living in the woods.
Tell us, since our some of our listeners may not know what it means to live out in the woods.
Right.
Thank you. Sorry.
Just
to cut down the cost of seminary.
He had a really nice Coleman stove.
No, there are some pretty nice apartments out on the, what is that, the west end of campus.
Right.
Which are for families, students with families, students that are married and so forth, not single students that live in the dormitory. But yeah, so we lived out there with, you know, scores and scores of kids playing with our kids out in the woods. And we had a great time doing it. And then I went out to a parish in Junction City, Kansas, and thought I was going to be a parish pastor for the rest of my life when the seminary called and said, we're having a really hard time finding parish pastors in the LCMS with your background in counseling. Would you come and interview? And I tried to say no because I was having just a great time in parish ministry and congregation was growing. We just moved to 2 services. It was a bad time to move for the congregation's sake, but some faculty did convince me that I should consider this strongly, and I did, and have been teaching here for 15 years now, and it's been a wonderful place to be. And I don't think this book and this influence that I'm starting to have in the Christian counseling field would have happened if I was still in a parish. Concordia Seminary allows that. On Friday, I was speaking a podcast, a video podcast with Houston Baptist University on this book and these issues. One of the professors there is highly interested in Luther and what Luther can contribute to it. So he asked me to do that. So it's all those little things that, faculty get known outside of our Lutheran circles, outside of our Concordia Seminary circles, and do slowly get asked to do these things. So
that's great. So what advice would you have for people who are thinking about maybe coming to seminary, especially if, you know, we talk to a lot of students as they're coming in, and students regularly, when they're applying to Concordia Seminary, they're telling us their whole story, and we're helping them to be whole and healthy and to get started on a great foot. And so sometimes we learn that people have mental health needs, or they've had some time in counseling. I'm a big proponent of personal counseling. My wife and I talk about it all the time. It's really healthy. It's good. It's not just for people that are, have really extreme cases. Counseling is a really good thing for Christians, right?
Yeah.
So any advice for people that are thinking about coming to seminary, but maybe have some past where they've struggled with some mental health issues?
Yeah, I am glad that the church is taking mental health issues more seriously than I think we were 30 or 40 years ago. When I first got into the field, there were just a lot of people that would say, oh, why are you going? I had pastors who tell me, why are you going into that field? That's not for Christians to go into, because psychology has had kind of a bad relationship with, secular psychology has had a bad relationship with the Christian church for decades, and it's in some ways gotten worse in the last decade. So, but still, mental health is extremely important. Christians struggle with the fall, with the groaning creation of the fall, just like non-Christians do. And so Christians struggle with depression and anxiety disorders and schizophrenia and other things at the same sort of numbers that non-Christians do. How can we help them with the care of their souls in ways that not just deals with them on the horizontal level, the first article, the created order level? Stop me if I use terms that I need to be explained a little bit more, but psychology is really good at doing research and finding out how things work on a creation level, but psychology is not good at all on what to do with the vertical stuff with our relationship with God. And that's even where Christian psychology and Christian counseling is not very good, because a lot of what passes for Christian counseling is, oh good, you're a Christian, now if you just follow these 6 steps, you'll be a happier, healthier, less depressed, less anxious Christian.
Yeah.
And the counselors don't even realize, because they haven't been theologically trained well enough, and even if they have been theologically trained, they haven't been influenced by Luther, they don't realize that six steps are another version of the law. Mm-hmm. And so a person tries to do these six steps, and they don't feel like they did them well enough, and then they feel guilty, and so then they feel like, okay, if I just had more faith, then I would be a better Christian, I wouldn't be so depressed. Where we need to distinguish between the strength of our faith and the strength of our Savior. And that's actually chapter 9 in the book. One particular strategy I've been using for years on helping people to distinguish between the strength of their faith and the strength of the Savior in which they have faith. And that's what Luther was trying to communicate to everybody. So,
I also think there are a lot of things in life that people don't realize weigh on their mental health. Mm-hmm. And so I do counseling. Counseling is big in our family. Dorothy was a psychology. Okay, you know, I'd have to ask her. She was close to either double majoring or she got a minor in psychology. I think she was like a class away from a double major in theology and in psychology. And it's one of those things that, for all of the reasons you are talking about, are things that she really pays attention to, that kind of stuff. But for me personally, I see a counselor, but one of the bigger things that didn't come up until recently, because I had taken a big gap between counseling and counseling, and a lot of life happened in, you know, close to a decade of me deciding to go back to a counselor. And so, but I have rheumatoid arthritis, and it's a chronic physical condition.
Yeah.
One of the more frustrating things that happens when I tell people I have it is like, oh, you're too young. It's like, I wish that were the case, but nonetheless, I have it. And it's one of those things where I don't have too much control over it. There are things that I can do, diet, exercise, try to manage stress and all these other things to lessen it. But when it's bad and people just think, oh, like my hands hurt or my knees hurt, that's not the case. It does attack your joints, and that's like one of the more common things it does, but also attacks soft tissues. Mm. And it like, imagine waking up in the morning the day before you were just fine, and the next day you have a flu, but you're not sick. Well, you're sick, but you just don't have a flu.
Yeah.
And I wasn't paying attention to how much it was taxing me mentally to try to be a pastor, to try to be a husband, to try to be a father, try to be a good friend, and to do all these different things when I myself physically felt terrible. And then, of course, the mental strain of it, then inevitably you begin to neglect spiritual care for yourself. And I just this morning, if I've said this before, if you don't have a journaling Bible, you should purchase one, because you don't get to control what you read and what you don't read. And not knowing that we were going to talk about this today, a verse that has hit home to me ever since I was diagnosed with RA is John chapter 9, the blind man. And the disciples ask, who sinned that caused this man to be blind? And it's one of those things there. I have had moments like that. It's like, whose fault is this? Oh, well, my dad has already, so maybe it's his fault. it's really not. But that's the thing. It's like, what have I done? There have been times it's like, what have I done to have this disease so young that has impacted me this way? And it's not about that. Mm-hmm. But talking about the spirituality, there are a lot of things in life that can get us to question spirituality. And it doesn't have to be this big wham thing in your face. It can be this little thing that pokes at you for a very long time that eventually builds up. So again, talking about the things you're talking about with Luther and caring for people's souls and looking at the whole person and not just one issue, but you know, that's why I appreciate counseling so much, because it's like you start talking about a thing and then you start talking about other things, and it's like, oh, I didn't even know that thing was bothering me. And it's just good to, especially I go to a Christian counselor, happens to be Lutheran as well, to be able to talk to somebody who doesn't just frame it in a flat world kind of, this is the biology of it. We do talk about those types of things, but she always wraps it back around in a spiritual way that is very beneficial to me.
Yeah. And that's, again, one of the things that, again, a lot of Christian counselors aren't aware of is Luther's theology of the cross. Mm-hmm. What do we do with human suffering? I mean, Hal Sinkbeil, a friend of mine that was the executive director of Doxology, I heard him say once, you know, it's important to ask Christian counselors, how do you deal with suffering? Because you're probably going to get an answer that's either a theology of glory answer, you know, trying to help people overcome their suffering, or, which may be important, but how are you going to help them cope with the suffering that we have in this life? And how do we deal with it, not just individually, but how do we deal with the mutual encouragement of the saints? How do congregations help people? And again, a lot of congregations help people who are suffering in some very wondrous ways. I mean, how do we, you know, cook lunches for people that have just lost a loved one after the funeral? And yeah, that's one of those little ways that, but how can also Christians go and visit each other in the hospital, visit each other in the mental hospital if they know that a friend is in the hospital for depression or anxiety disorder or whatever it might be? Again, COVID has affected a lot of that right now, but just feeling comfortable going and visiting any friend who's in the hospital, whether it's for arthritis or heart attack or depression, how can we help? And one of the things I tell students in classes, I said, if you had a parishioner that comes into your office and says, "Pastor, would you pray with me?" I said, "Well, yeah, what are we praying about?" I said, "Well, I'm having this sharp pain in this upper left quadrant of my chest. It's kind of running down my left arm."
Oh, yikes.
Yeah. You'd say, "Okay, we're going to pray, but we're going to pray in my car while I'm driving you to the emergency right. room because you may be having a heart attack." I mean, we go to specialists, medical doctors who have the equipment to help somebody who's having a heart attack. Why don't we go to specialists, especially ones that are comfortable talking about the gospel, go to specialists who can help with the mental disorder, mental illness issues that might be going on for some people because they were genetically predisposed to depression or they had traumatic incidents happen to them during their childhood. I mean, we don't talk enough about the trauma of some kids in childhood, especially mm-hmm. sexual trauma. It's just so rampant, too rampant in our culture, in all cultures, and it creates all kinds of mental health issues for people then when they come into their adulthood. So how can they trust other people if adults were not trustworthy when they were children?
Right.
So
another thing, you mentioned COVID, and I've just been thinking a lot about people and how they're coping with this entire pandemic. It has been lots to cope yeah. with. It has left a lot of people stressed and anxious about all kinds of things. I think it's taking a mental health toll mm-hmm. on many people. And some people don't even know it, Micah, like what you were saying. I mean, a lot of us don't stop to even spend time to think about our own mental health or to kind of assess where we're at with things, right? So what do you think about stress? Stress is not exactly like, you know, OCD or schizophrenia, not maybe a diagnosable illness, but I think probably everybody in the 21st century deals with stress to some level, and it has certainly it has bodily ramifications, but a lot of it is kind of mental and emotional. So what do you think about stress as a phenomenon, and what are some things that you would tell people that are dealing with loads of stress? Yeah. And I might even be listening personally, just saying.
It is one of those cases where, let me say, we all in our American culture feel like we want to be successful. We do all this extra stuff to make sure that we're good at our job, but we're also trying to be good with our families, and how do we balance all these aspects of life? It can be really stressful to not be in balance. And, you know, when our job demands 45 hours, 50 hours, 60 hours or more of work, and it's people-related stress. I mean, when I was a kid growing up, I sometimes worked 100-hour weeks on the farm, but I was sitting in a tractor cab running a tractor, and it was a lower stress sort of job. It was mm-hmm. it was stress. There was stuff involved, but different than talking to people as pastors or nurses or doctors do on a day-by-day basis. So as business people do, trying to be successful in their business. And again, COVID just came in and separated us from a lot of the mutual encouragement of the saints, a lot of the social support that we had from one another. And Yeah, I think depression levels, anxiety levels went up. I just spoke to a group of counselors for the Wisconsin Synod last month. And yeah, they were just noting how many more counseling hours that their group, they had. Wisconsin Synod has like 110 Christian counselors, mostly in Wisconsin and Minnesota, but they're spread in like six other states around. And yeah, I don't remember how many tens of thousands of hours of counseling contact they had, a large percentage of it on video contact, because that's a lot of what counselors had to do during the main first 8 months or whatever of COVID. But yeah, people are reaching out and getting the help. Just there's probably a lot more people that are not reaching out and getting that help. So yeah, I'm glad to hear you two feel comfortable going and seeing counselors. And why do we Americans, especially we American men, think that we have to pull ourselves up by our own emotional bootstraps? When the way God designed us, man should not be alone. And that doesn't just mean with a wife. That means we are social creatures, how he designed us. We are part of the body of Christ. How do we reach out to other parts of the body to seek their benefit, seek their care of our soul? How can we care for the souls of others? Galatians 6:2, carry each other's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. How can we appropriately carry each other's burdens in prayer? And sometimes a lot of times a counselor doesn't have an answer, but just knowing that, you know, somebody else is carrying that burden with you and praying with you and for you through that struggle is very helpful, very enlightening. So.
Yeah, I often, in when I was in the parish, I would tell people, you know, if your car isn't running correctly, there might be a few things that you can do on your own to get your car to run better, right? Put gas into it, make sure that it has a fresh oil change every once in a while or whatever. But eventually you need an expert, and you take it to the auto mechanic and they know more than you do. And so they, but why it doesn't strike us that we have to take our own body or our own kind of mental and emotional self to an expert and say, check this out, things aren't quite, you know, I'm not running on all cylinders or whatever metaphor we use.
Yeah.
So let's shift the conversation a little bit. So we've talked a little bit about kind of personal stuff, but in the classroom, the thing that you're primarily teaching is those who will be future pastors or future deaconesses, in how they give this soul care to other people. So we certainly aren't certifying everybody to be counselors out there. So what are we trying to do in the classroom where we're getting pastors and deaconesses ready to do soul care?
Yeah, good. Thank you. Yeah, and I even make that distinction in the book. I mean, I think Christian counselors and pastors and deaconesses and others are all soul care givers. But Christian counselors tend to focus on people's suffering and people's biopsychosocial disorders, the things that they're struggling with that are diagnosable. Pastors and deaconesses tend to deal with people's suffering, but also with their sin and challenging their sin with law and comforting them with gospel. It's kind of three corners of a triangle in the book that I borrow from Eric Johnson, who's at Houston Baptist University. And so yeah, the pastors and deaconesses, we tend to stay on that, but we do hit on the, you know, you need to know a little bit about all these different disorders, so we do 2 or 3 weeks at the end of the semester with that. The basics are, you know, in the first week or two of the class, we take, okay, here's what you've been learning in the systematic theology classes about this Luther's theology. Here's how it applies to care of souls. Then we spend a couple of weeks with listening skills, because you might not be aware of this, but not all young men or even middle-aged men are good listeners.
I don't believe it.
So, again, I was shocked when I went to grad school in counseling thinking, you know, they were going to reveal to me the deep, dark secrets and how to do this counseling stuff. And we spent 2 semesters taking listening skills classes in a master's degree program. So 2 weeks in a pastoral care class is just hitting the the surface, but it's at least getting to the surface. And a lot of guys go, oh, I had no idea that this was how I communicate to other people. Yeah.
I didn't become a good active listener, and I'm not saying I'm a great one, but I didn't actually start practicing it until I got married and I was like, oh, I actually need to listen to what my wife is saying. Well, I can't do it passively.
Communicate to her that I am listening. Yes.
It took me a while to learn how to listen because I had my own emotions that I was trying to deal with. And right. I was very nervous when anybody else would have emotions. So I would immediately shut down my listening and think, how can I fix this? Because I was nervous when other people had emotions. So I had to kind of stop and learn why I had such kind of visceral reactions to people's emoting.
Well, I tend to be the problem solver. I mean, this even started when I was in high school, that somehow there became a rumor going around that Rick Mars was good at helping other high school students solve their problems. So I would have people like stop me. I'd be sitting watching a basketball game and somebody would just come down and say, hey, I heard you're good at problem solving. Could you help me with this problem? And I'd listen to him for 3 minutes and then spurt out some 17-year-old wisdom. And I'm sure I was messing up other 17-year-olds' lives. But, thanks. And so, you know, I have to be careful with that because I still fall back into that same process, even as a husband. You know, my wife will start telling me about the struggles of her day. And instead of listening to her, I'll start to say, well, did you think about solving it this way? And she looks at me and goes, and you teach other people how to listen? Okay. Sorry, dear. I fell back into my old habits. So, listening is just an incredibly important skill. And then after they've learned some of the basics of listening and proven to me on a test that they can actually, and through role plays and stuff, that they can actually do some basic listening skills, then we go more into like premarital counseling, grief counseling, part of the pastoral care class is now how to write a funeral sermon, how to write a wedding sermon, how to deal with weddings, and how to structure liturgically funerals so that they're comforting to people. But then outside the funeral and outside the wedding, how do you help people care for their souls at those major stages of life when they've either getting married to someone or they've lost someone significant in their life. And then we get into the mental health issues. Yeah, it's a semester-long class, and I'm really glad we have 14 weeks to deal with it, but they don't become master's-level counselors. Yeah, they just know enough to hopefully not do too much damage when they see a biopsychosocial disorder, but they do know enough to help people who are struggling with their suffering, and they do know how to, you know, Galatians 6:1, brothers, if someone is trapped in a sin, you who are spiritual should restore them, but gently, lest you yourself fall into temptation. When they see somebody who is struggling with a sin, how do they confront that sin in a way that the person realizes that that pastor actually cares for their soul, not just wanting to slap them upside the head because they've committed a sin again? So,
and where is the line between, so a pastor, oftentimes when I was a pastor, people would come to me first because they knew me and they saw me every Sunday, and a lot of people just didn't know the first thing to do if they were going to try to get a counselor. They wouldn't even know where to turn. There was a teenage pregnancy in the congregation, and they turned to me first because they knew me and they didn't know any counselor. Right. So when does a pastor or a deaconess know this is maybe a little bit beyond the classes that I took? They were really great from Dr. Mars, but Dr. Mars taught me that I should hand off at a certain point. Where's the handoff? When do you know I'm out of my league on this one? Probably need to get a counselor involved.
Yeah. And it is, if it's a biopsychosocial disorder or a marital counseling thing that is so complicated that you think, okay, this is kind of beyond what I learned in three class periods at the seminary about marriage counseling. We do spend an entire class period, maybe a class period and a half, on referral issues. Mm-hmm. And pastors need to go out and meet the Christian counselors in their community, interview them, spend time with them, see which ones they would feel comfortable going to themselves or that they would refer their son or daughter or wife to if they had some sort of struggle. And then make a list of those counselors and then refer their parishioners, maybe after one session, but maybe after two, three, four sessions of pastoral counseling. again, a lot of times people come to their pastors and don't actually tell them, this is my real problem. They actually come and tell them some other surface problem, and if the pastor is good at listening, then maybe an hour or two or 3 hours later, then they'll say, well, I haven't told you yet, but I was sexually abused as a child. Mm-hmm. Well, then that pastor probably needs to get them, especially if it's a woman, to a female counselor to help them through the abuse issues that they've been dealing with for 10 or 20 years that they just haven't talked through with anybody. But they trusted the pastor enough to at least start that process. And so yeah. He's an important soul caregiver that doesn't just throw them over to the counselor and never talk to them again, but checks in with them again every month or two to say, how's your counseling going with this person that I referred you to?
Oh, that's great.
You know, when I was in domestic missionary just up north in Ferguson, I did a, and I used to be very explicit when people would come to me. I say, I do pastoral counseling. Mm-hmm. And they'd be like, oh, you're a counselor. I said, no, I do pastoral counseling. I was like, so all of this is going to be framed up in my understanding of who we are, right, and my understanding of who God is and my understanding of his relationship to us and then how that bleeds into our relationship with others. Especially if it were a couple or something like that, especially if they weren't married. And I was like, you know, first and foremost, you have to, you know, understand that I can't make the two of you move out, nor am I necessarily your pastor at this moment, but understand that the two of you living together, not being married, from my chair, is part of your problem. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting because of and most pastors aren't going to run into this. It's just because I was a missionary in Ferguson and I didn't have my own parish. I was just there for people. And the people at the Urban League, once they trusted me as a pastor, started referring people like, mm-hmm. oh, go talk to Pastor Glenn. Mm-hmm. For all the reasons you said, I would listen mm-hmm. and I would do my best to say, this is what you said. This is how I'm understanding it. Am I off? Am I spot on? But through that and caring for people that way that necessarily weren't, none of them were Lutheran by any stretch of the imagination. Some of them had been Christian. Most of them weren't active Christians. But simply by being there for somebody, because whether somebody believes in God or not, they still have a created soul. And caring for their soul that way, a lot of people, I mean, it stopped being just Pastor Glenn and just pastor. I feel like when they drop your name and they just say pastor, yeah. There is a significant shift in their relationship with you. And it became, for me, a really strong way to reach out to the community. Again, there were times when people would say things I'm like, listen, I'm definitely not qualified mm-hmm. to begin to answer your question. It's like, you need professional counseling for that. And I think the Salvation Army had resources for that. But it can be a way, and it can be a very deep and great way to get to know somebody outside the church and then demonstrate to them the gospel via simply just being a pastor, sitting across the table from somebody and doing what we're taught to do in pastoral counseling, like you say. Yeah, and whenever people ask, I'm like, listen, I never paid attention in psychology classes, the ones I was forced to take, so I'm not the guy that you want to talk to about that. But this, listening to you and hearing what you're going through, I'm relatively qualified for that. Mm-hmm. Just, I mean, not because I'm a pastor, because I'm a person. Yeah. But it's just such a wonderful tool. So I remember pastor's counseling, and you were my prof for that.
Yeah, I thought so.
And I remember going through all that, and we've kind of begun to broach the discernment and distinction between professional counseling and pastoral counseling, if we're going to label it that way. I'm comfortable mm-hmm. telling people that. In a regular pastoral counseling setting, and we've talked about, at this point you need to refer, and we've gone to the edge, but is there anything like explicit beyond the ones that are kind of obvious, where somebody at the bottom of a conversation says, hey, by the way, I was abused as a kid. What are ways of that we can, as non-trained counselors, as just Christians, brothers and sisters in Christ, listen to people to try to hear some of the more other psychosis type issues where somebody's becoming erratic, or are there ways that we can responsibly, not diagnose, but at least listen for those types of things?
Well, if it is a psychosis related sort of thing, it's going to be fairly obvious fairly quickly.
Okay.
So, I mean, people are going to say, yeah, I'm hearing these voices, and you're going to realize, okay, they're not hearing voices that are actually real voices. So yeah, that tends to come out fairly straightforwardly. It's usually more the I've never told anybody this, but you know, I was traumatized as a child sort of mm-hmm. thing that I think takes trust to develop. And that trust doesn't usually develop just in one session. It usually takes two or three or more sessions before somebody starts calling you pastor.
Right.
I liked how you phrased that. Even goes back to, I mean, pastor does not mean counselor. Pastor means shepherd. And shepherd of a flock of sheep, either a particular congregation or, in your case, the missionary, kind of sheep that were coming in and out. I say that. I grew up on a sheep farm. I mean, my dad was a farmer, and he was the president of the Kansas Sheep Association for a number of years when I was a kid. So we had up to 1,000 sheep, 2,000 after they had their lambs on our farm at any one time. So I know what it means to be a shepherd. And I always tell students, when Jesus says, "You are my sheep and I am your good shepherd," he's not giving us a compliment. Because sheep are the least bright of all farm animals except for chickens. And so, you know, he's telling us you need a shepherd because you'll do things that will harm you. One of the things I had to do as a kid when I grew up, got big enough, Dad made me go out and walk the fence at the end of the day because sheep will stick their head through a fence and they're not, to get the grass on the other side, and they're not smart enough to pull their head out of the fence. And so I had to physically pick a sheep up that was bigger than me, turn it on its side, and pull it out sideways to get it out of the fence. And you know, I never had a sheep tell me thank you for doing that.
Imagine.
But again, that's kind of, people are much better with us than sheep are in that way. But it does kind of show us, you know, yeah, sheep get themselves into all kinds of trouble, and they need to be helped by the shepherd through that trouble. Good news is the shepherd also has veterinarians that he can then call and refer the sheep to if they are really sick in some significant way that's beyond his particular way of caring for them. So,
well, and that kind of makes me think of what we do for our own students here. So you're one of the most compassionate people that I know, especially on the faculty have a lot of compassionate people, but you have for the time that you've been here at the seminary, been involved in things like the ministerial formation and spiritual care committee, the kind of caring for students in these holistic ways and making sure that we're not just an institution, we're not just a place to get a degree, but we're also caring for people in holistic ways, involved in things like the formation program and making sure that the whole curriculum is taking care of the entire person. So I don't know, any kind of closing thoughts as we're kind of wrapping up here. What does that look like here at the seminary?
Yeah, I do think that's one of the most important things that we did in the curriculum change from a few years ago, add in a formation hour so that every week students meet together in a group of about 15 with one faculty member, and then they talk about their own formation issues, their relational health, their emotional health, their financial health, whatever. There's 8 different issues. I won't go through all 8 of them. But yeah, we spend time on each one of those health areas. So it's not learning more exegesis and not learning more systematics all the time. It's, those things are important, and learning more pastoral counseling, but it's also how do we deal with the basic formation issues. And so students know if they have a particular issue, they at least have one faculty member that they meet with weekly that they can go, "Hey, could you help me? Could we sit and talk about this for an hour or so next week?" Their mentor is their first person to kind of go to. And again, the mentor might not have the answers, but he at least can refer them on to somebody else. So I do think that this formation hour aspect, and again, Tim Seleska, the dean of ministerial formation, was the one that really pushed it through. And I just, again, the irony that his father was my mentor back when I was 18 years old. So great working with Tim during the years. I'm not doing that anymore. I'm just a faculty member because I need to have some time to go out and do the speaking engagements, and I can't do administrative things and teach and do all these other things. So I thank Concordia Seminary for giving me a little bit of administrative relief to do that. But it's extremely important, and I'm really glad that David Lewis is now the director of the MDiv program and doing a really fine job of helping students along those ways. So
that's great, and we'll catch up with Dr. Lewis later on in the season. But this has been a lot of fun to talk about Making Christian Counseling More Christ-Centered, your book from Westbow Press, and listeners can pick that up out on Amazon if they're looking for a good book. So this has been another episode of Under the Fig Tree Podcast, and we look forward to being with you again next week.
Yep, and thanks so much for joining us, Rick.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been great. This is fun. Yeah, you guys are good together.
I appreciate that.